Hey, welcome to Radio Labyrinth, the Gen X pop culture podcast that covers any and all things movie, television, radio, podcasts, books, cassette tapes, 45 RPM records. As long as we're into them, I'm your host, Tim Andrews, a regional semi-famous Atlanta radio personality appearing Monday through Friday on WSB Radio on the Von Hessler Doctrine. I have to name the show. And my co-host is Jeff Leboff joining us this week. Another co-host, Dustin Lawler. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing okay. Jeff, how are you?
I'm okay.
I like your background. Thank you.
Yeah, happy birthday, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, this show drops actually on the 4th of November, which is my birthday. November Spawned a Monster, my favorite Morrissey song. Coming up later in the show, we have a fun interview with pop culture author and film historian Lee Gambin, all the way from Australia. Jeff and I recorded it Saturday morning, and it was a lot of fun. We could have talked to him for like 3 hours probably, because he's just so knowledgeable about all this stuff. But he has a brand new book out right now called Tonight on a Very Special Episode, A History of Sitcoms That Sometimes Got Serious. Now, this is volume one from 1957 to 1985, and you can get that at Amazon.com or, you know, order it from your local bookstore if you want to. And there is a second volume available for pre-order, which covers 1986 to when, Jeff, 2000-something?
Yeah, it goes into the 2000s.
Now, the reason I guess we discovered this maybe was we were going to do something with very special episodes, and then I saw what a daunting task that was going to be. And then Jeff found this book and this author, and he pretty much covers it. So everything you need to know about very special episodes is covered in this book. And yep. Lee is extremely knowledgeable about that era of television. And
yeah, it's so weird. Somebody from Australia knows so much about American TV, but I guess that's all they had down there.
Yeah, and he gave us some shows that you can watch that are Australian. He gave us some tips. That was one thing I wanted to know. Like, we don't have a lot of Australian TV shows on here, and they have tons, and they've always had tons of American shows. So I wanted to get some suggestions from him about shows we should check out from Australia. So he gave those to us as well. So that'll be coming up later in the show. I wanted to welcome our brand new Radio Labyrinth Patreon supporter. Her name is Tracy McCoy, and she just joined up. So, Tracy, you are due a care package of stickers and pins, and that will be on its way shortly. Send a message with your address. And remember, a lot of you out there are due stickers, and we need a message from you so we can get those in the mail. Tim will ship them out to you. Wanted to thank Autumn Fisher for joining the show with us last week. That was a lot of fun. You can hear her weekly on the One Topic podcast with Greg Russ. And, of course, both of those guys are on the Von Hessler Doctrine Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to noon on WSB Radio. As a matter of fact, she and I did Donald Trump and Melania Trump in a recreation of a famous scene from the classic Stanley Kubrick film, The Shining. And it was a lot of fun to do, and it actually came out very well. And
yeah, Dustin did a great job on the video.
Yeah, absolutely. Good job, man.
Thank you, guys. That was fun. The Shining being one of my favorite movies, that was fun to play with.
Isn't that, like, it's one of my favorite movies based on a Stephen King story, and Stephen King hates it, so there you go. We're going to be doing another one today, but to get access to that, you need to be a Radio Labyrinth Patreon. You can sign up at patreon.com/ Tim Andrews. This week, we're going to be doing a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross, and I will be playing Alec Baldwin, right? Alec Baldwin role as Caitlyn Jenner. So, let's see. Jeff put together this really cool thing, and I want to thank you for it on my birthday, which is today, or the 4th of November, whenever you're consuming this. Could be any day of the week. But on Sunday, Jeff put together a Facebook group, really ostensibly, you know, wishing me a happy birthday and trying to get some of our old high school friends on there, and ended up being really, really awesome, because there was a group of people that hung out when we were in high school. It was me, Jeff, our buddy Stu, who's been on this show, and we still talk all the time, the three of us. Of course, Jeff and I talk all the time, and Stu, you know, we're the three amigos. But there were two three other people that we hung out with in high school pretty much on a daily basis. And two of those guys showed up. So it was Sean Smith and Denny Barnett, two guys we've known our whole lives. And we ended up, I think, 2.5, almost 3 hours just catching up. It was really awesome. So I want to thank you for that, Jeff. And I want to thank
a couple other people popped in too.
Yeah, we had Tammy Shear, and I know you people don't know who these people are, but
Mike Hall popped in. They know who that he is.
Mike Hall,
owner of Atlanta Pizza and Euro.
Oh yeah, oh duh, Mike Hall. I'm talking about Mansfield people. Yeah, thank you to Mike Hall. He popped in right away. He also graduated from high school in 1988. For when you said his name, we had a kid like Tom Hall or something, and that's who that popped into my head. Old college buddy who listens to this show and is still a friend, Mark Gardner, who lives up in New York State. And Jim Scouten is his name. He popped in to say hello. And that was really cool. So, again, thank you, Jeff. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was fun.
So, you know, we have the Redbox Troll. I have a non-Halloween, a non-horror movie coming up for Rad Libs later on. But first of all, I guess we have to say goodbye to Sean Connery.
Yeah.
90s is a good run though.
Yeah, absolutely. What Dustin?
No, I've been thinking the last few months, like, you know, I guess his dementia had gotten really bad, so he'd been out of the public eye for the last
for president.
Couple of years.
Sorry.
That's almost over with, thank God. I don't really give a shit at this point.
Are you kidding me? It's just beginning. Anyway, we hadn't seen him in a long time. I didn't know he had dementia, though.
Yeah, I don't know if it was his wife or whoever takes care of him said it had been getting really bad. And I know TMZ had tried to catch him a few times when he'd been out. And, you know, he was kind of undercover, kind of keeping it quiet. But yeah, that was a blow, man. I mean, 2020 just keeps on dishing it out.
It does, you know. But when somebody's 90 years old and they pass away, I'm really not all that shocked. It's like, oh, you know, he hasn't been in a movie in I don't know how many years, and you know what I mean. He was old when we were young, you know.
Oh yeah.
But you know, it's 2020 really adds up when people that you don't expect to die pass away, you know, like the younger people who die, not the older people, but it is still a big loss because he is such a pop culture icon beyond just James Bond, you know. I guess he's the original James Bond to do multiple films, and certainly the coolest and most sexiest of all the James Bonds.
Yeah, he's kind of the go-to when you think James Bond. You think his roles were always the most iconic.
Yeah.
Plus, he's Indiana Jones' dad.
Yeah, Indiana Jones' father. He did another movie that...
Highlander.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Highlander was great. I have a little list of some of my favorites. The Untouchables, of course, is awesome. That was... 1987 that came out. I saw it in the at a drive-through in Wildwood, New Jersey, and it was really cool. Not a drive-in. I saw it was a boardwalk movie theater. I don't know what I'm thinking about. But we were in Wildwood, a friend of mine and I, that summer, and went and saw that. It was great. He was great in it. The Rock, of course, with Nick Cage.
Pretty great movie.
Entertaining film. The Hunt for Red October with Alec Baldwin. Highlander, of course, which is an iconic film, and on and on and on. I never was a big fan of him in the Indiana Jones movies, and I'm not really that big into Indiana Jones. So
he's only a couple years older than Harrison Ford.
How old is Harrison Ford?
Yeah, 70-something.
Oh, yeah. Chewie, we're home. Yeah. Did you happen to see the Millennium Falcon in one of the Mandalorian this season on the Mandalorian? Did you happen to see the Millennium Falcon in a junkyard? That's pretty interesting. I saw that. Anyway, back to Sean Connery. Zardoz, is that how you say that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a cool movie. That's the one where he's like semi-naked, right? And
he's wrapped in a Borat outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a red curtain. Like one piece of cloth just twisted around his body.
And that's a character that people march in the Dragon Con parade. They all dress up like that character, and they have like a little brigade. It's pretty cool.
They have little Easter Island masked guys chasing them down.
There's anything. Oh, that movie. He did a movie with Lorraine Bracco that was terrible. I saw it in the theater. He kept calling her Bronx. I forget the name of it, but they were down in South America looking for drugs.
The Medicine Man?
Yeah, that's a, come on, Bronx.
Yeah. Found the cure for cancer in the rainforest.
Right. That was one of those movies that was really miscast because that's not the kind of role she should be doing. Not that she should always be a psychiatrist or a mob wife, but that was just a strange film. So rest in peace, Sean Connery. I don't really know what else is going on. Dave Chappelle.
Let me be the first to hail our new Kanye overlord.
Kanye, you think he's going to win? You think Kanye's the president? Who do you think? Okay, let's go. Jeff, you start. Who do you think is going to win? Make your prediction.
Kanye.
Okay. Dustin.
Who do I think is going to win?
Not who you want, just who do you think?
I think Trump's going to win, but definitely, and I'm straight up not who I want, but I think he will. I think he will. Unfortunately, whether it's done through the night of and regular voting or the process that's going to drag out for the next 2 to 3 months afterwards.
See, I think that my opinion. I think that Joe Biden is going to win. I think he'll win Pennsylvania and Florida, and that'll be the end of it. And then
Trump's going to declare victory in Pennsylvania tomorrow night, though.
What's that?
Trump's going to declare victory in Pennsylvania tomorrow night.
He's going to be locked up in the White House. He's not going anywhere.
No, but he's going to declare victory in Pennsylvania.
Oh, well, he probably already has. So we're talking like you're listening to this after the election's over or as it's, after the election's over. So we could all be fucked up and maybe Nancy Pelosi will end up being president. One can only hope. Speaking of that, Dave Chappelle is in Atlanta this week doing practice sets at a Norcross Comedy Club, getting ready to host Saturday Night Live this week, post-election show. So that gives me a reason to watch it. I haven't watched it at all this season. I heard John Mulaney did really well. Did you guys watch it?
Yeah, it was good.
I just watched his monologue. It was good. It was really good. He's always good. He's probably one of the best stand-up comedians now that's true to the art, true to the form, of being a comedian, and that's where it stops. He doesn't try to push anything. He just he comes up with the funny, and he's great. You can definitely tell he's influenced a lot of writing in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. He's been writing for different things, but yeah, he's a great storyteller.
Other than that, I spent most of my weekend cleaning up from the tropical storm. I got that all finished on Saturday. Got, I think, 7 bags of sticks out of the yard. 7. I pick up all the fucking sticks, and then I'm anal about it. I break them in half so I can get them in the bag. So it's a pain in the ass, but what are you going to do? Don't really have any other news up here. No other news in Hollywood, Jeff?
Yeah, I haven't been paying attention.
I haven't either.
Yeah, it's one of those things kind of just been putting my head down and going forward.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everything feels like. It's like, I don't know. It's funny. It's like all this, every year at election time, it has this same kind of drone, but this year it just seems a little more tense.
I was happy to watch the Bills defeat the Patriots in New England for the first time, I think, since 2011. So that was nice. That was really nice to watch. They pretty much gave the game away. And if it hadn't been for the defensive play knocking the ball out of Fumbly's hands, they would have lost, but or at least had to go into overtime. So that was exciting. Meanwhile, Tom Brady is like taking Tampa Bay to this. I think they're going to go to the Super Bowl this year. So wouldn't that be funny if it were the Bills and Tampa Bay and the Bills lost again?
That's just going to spur on Brady's God stature.
Yeah. Give it one more. I don't like Cam Newton, so the more he loses, the better. I used to like him. I used to root for the Carolina Panthers when he was there, first couple of years. But then he started, when he doesn't win or something doesn't go his way, he pouts and acts like a baby. So I don't know. I don't follow it all that much. I don't care all that much is what I'm saying. But football to me is the one sport that feels normal. even though there were no people at Ralph Wilson Stadium or whatever they call it, Rich Stadium in Buffalo, there were no people there. You watch a game anywhere in the South, Southwest.
Florida's open for full crowds.
Really?
So I thought tonight's game would be huge crowds, but it's in New York instead of being in Florida.
Oh, so there won't be anybody there to watch the Giants lose? Yeah. Sorry, Jeff. I think they're going to lose.
Will still lose.
Yeah. but other than that, I didn't really watch an awful lot of TV or anything, which we'll talk about after the interview. So why don't we just go ahead and move on to the interview with Lee, and we'll come back and we'll talk to you then.
Now's the time we thank all of our Radio Labyrinth producers. Producer is a Radio Labyrinth Patreon member who donates $25 a month or more to our podcast. So, without further ado, thank you, Chad Shepherd, who is also a sponsor, who comes in at the $50 mark, and we appreciate it very, very much. Chad has been a member since October 6th, 2017, and we love you for it. Also, thank you to Brian Smith, Eric Malmstrom. Eric has been with us for almost 4 years. John Sutherland, member since 2018. Keith Tate, since October 14th, 2016. Matt Carter, since November 12th, 2016. Mike D, since August 1st, 2018. Tim Slayton, Sean Hall, since April 22nd, 2018. Todd Ellis, a member since January 19th, 2020. He's the youngest one. And last but not least, Emily Warren, who joined up on May 19th, 2018. Thank you to each and every one of you so very much.
All right, joining us, as we mentioned earlier, is Lee Gambin, and he is a writer, author, film historian. He writes for Fangoria, Shock Till You Drop, Delirium, Warner Brothers, and Scream Magazine. He has written the books Massacred by Mother Nature, Exploring the Natural Horror Film, We Can Be Who We Are, movie musicals of the 1970s, and the soon-to-be-released The Howling, which I look forward to. I hope there's a whole chapter on Sybil Danning ripping her top off. Studies in the horror film, and he runs the Melbourne, Australia-based film society, Cinemaniacs, in lectures on cinema studies. His new book with collaborator Chris Wilson is called Tonight on a Very Special Episode, A History of Sitcoms That Sometimes Got Serious, Volume 1, 1957 to 1985. Lee, thank you for being on Radio Labyrinth.
Hi, that bio was lovely, but needs a massive update. So the Howling book is well and truly out. It's been around for I think nearly 2 years now, and also yeah, it's just me as sole editor on this book.
Okay,
and a bunch of very special contributors. But yeah. Thank you for the intro. Thank you for having me.
Now this is something that Jeff and I grew up together. We grew up in the same town. We have the same. Grew up watching the same TV shows, talking to it. So we've known each other since about 1980. And these episodes that are covered in your book are things that we've been talking about since they aired because of their uniqueness and how they're set apart from the rest of the series. And to find out that you've written not only one, but you have another massive volume talking about these episodes is just fascinating. So
yeah,
I guess let's start. How did you get into these shows and how did they have an impact on you?
Sure, much like you guys. So I grew up in front of television, big film fan, big TV fan. And I always loved sitcoms because there was something warm about them, there was a comfort factor about them. There was always a sort of, you know, and a lot of people, not a lot of friends later in like teen years, and I'd still like, want to watch things like Mr. Belvedere and All in the Family and, you know, whatever. They'd always think that sitcoms are a little bit saccharine and a little bit sort of fluffy and lightweight when I was like also a big gore hound and loved, you know, my slasher films and monster movies, etc. And they're like, oh, you know, they're too sentimental and weird and so American. And I'd be like, yeah, well, fuck you, I love them. So I grew up with them and really fell in love with them and really loved the characters and loved a wide range of the sitcoms. Whether it was kind of very overtly saccharine ones like Webster or Blossom, or really hard-hitting ones like Maude and the Jeffersons or All in the Family or the Norman Lear ones. But I love them all. And what I really responded to were the episodes that really struck a chord where they sort of lived outside of the normal realm of the function of the show. So they kind of had this really unnerving nature about them, and they were the very special episodes. So ones that had the maybe a warning beforehand, or had just had a somber tone, or there wasn't much of a laugh track going through, and that pricked my ears up as a kid. I remember them very distinctly. And one major memory I have, core focus of when I sort of, you know, go back and think of my childhood watching all these sitcoms, was A My Name Is Alex, because it aired here later than usual. From Family Ties. So Family Ties aired at 5:30 p.m. This one aired at night, and it was uninterrupted by commercials, and it was a black box, like, theater piece, you know, with this amazing performance from Michael J. Fox. And I was like, what is this? And it scared me as a kid. My sister and I taped it, and it just scared me. And I was like, this is amazing that these sitcoms can do this, really? And so then I sort of got more obsessed with it. And then years later, you know, outside of childhood into teens and 20s and 30s, just still watched all these shows. When they all came out on DVD, I was like, oh, fuck yes. I can just watch The Facts of Life all day. And then also prior to getting them on DVD and stuff, there was things like Nick at Night and stuff like that that we had here in Australia as well. So you had your cable network and you could pay for it. And you could just watch Gilligan's Island all day and The Munsters all day. And it was just awesome. And then, you know, I collected a whole bunch of stuff from taping it, but just, you know, rewatching and just being obsessed with these shows, all the Peter Engel shows, like, I was way too old for them, really, but they'd turn up on Saturday mornings, like Saved by the Bell and California Dreams, and I'd be obsessed with watching them, like, sometimes hungover or whatever, but I'd be like, yes, I need to see these shows. So it was all this kind of, you know, big sort of lead up, and then I thought, you know what? I'm up to my maybe sixth book now. I think I need to do something with television. So I thought, this is a good subject matter that no one, I feel, has probably written a book on. There's shitloads of blogs, and a lot of them are excellent. And there's some great podcasts. But just to do a book, I was like, yeah, I've got to do this. And I've got to structure it the right way. Anyway, so that's the sort of genesis of it. Just basically loving the shows, really being interested in the kind of dark subject matter that these shows tackled, falling in love with even more so things like the Norman Lear universe and the Susan Harris universe and all those kind of the intertwining shows, and just being in love with shows that had heart, and that weren't scared to say that they had heart, and made me cry and made me feel fuzzy and warm, because I felt these shows were beautiful. I feel like, and we'll talk about it in this conversation, but once we got to Seinfeld, that kind of thing got lost. And I remember the last episode of Seinfeld airing, and I was at a local punk rock pub in Melbourne called the Punners Club, which is no longer. And it aired there, and everyone was like quiet, and everyone's like, oh, wow, we're watching the last episode of Seinfeld. And while it was moving with that awful fucking Green Day song.
Yeah.
and whatever, while it was moving, because, you know, it's the end of an era, it's the end of the show, it was still ugly to me. I didn't feel like those characters resonated with me because they were just so freaking horrible.
Right. Well, that was the point of the episode. They paid for all their sins for being dicks for so long.
Exactly. But yeah, so it was like the end of that kind of phenomenon of the very special episode trend, which really has its roots in caring about these characters and having that sentimentality, you know, embedded within the fabric of the shows. So it was just fun to work on.
No, I was just going to say, like, every series now on network television especially is a very special episode. Like, This Is Us, that show every week is This Is a Very Special Episode. Because my wife cries. And, you know, if you watch it, you're like, oh, God, everybody's miserable on that show.
But, Is that a sitcom?
No, but it's that feeling every single week there's something horrible going on with somebody in that family.
Okay.
And the point is, though, is that sitcoms don't do this anymore because because there's so much to choose from. They don't need that kind of gimmick or whatever you want to call it. Now, is it a gimmick? Is that something you discovered, that it was a ratings gimmick, or is it something they felt they had?
It's really fascinating because the construction of the book changed. You mentioned Chris Wilson, who's a friend, and he was an early collaborator and since sort of dropped off, which is cool. But at the beginning, we were sort of wrestling with the idea of how to structure the book. We were like, oh, should it be by themes? But will that sort of be sort of topsy-turvy? Because, you know, rape might feature in multiple amounts of episodes and drug addiction, but where do we put bootlegging? you know, from what's happening. So yes. It's kind of like that. So what I decided to do eventually was just go chronological. And so what I found when you talk about fad trends and gimmicks is you look through the books and you look at the dates and you're like, oh my God, in the same 3 weeks, there's like 10 very special episodes from different shows. You're like, they're out playing each other. And sweet. Even the same show itself, like Facts of Life, is just relentless. I was like, where the fuck do I stop with this show? But, you know, we tried to pack it as much as we could. It starts at the very special episode, Roughhousing. The pilot episode is a very special episode for the Facts of Life. But, yeah, you find that... Wait.
Back up. You mean when they were still at the girls' school, when they all lived in that one building together?
First episode. So when it sort of, when it passes the baton from Different Strokes to Facts of Life.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can talk about that one because it's one of my favorites actually. But yes, definitely a trend thing. But I feel my argument is, and it's written in the introduction to the book, that the very special episode actually has its roots way earlier than sitcoms becoming a thing. It actually sort of has its roots with the advent of the PSA, so the PSA film. Okay. So, you know, boys beware and girls learn how to do, you know, feminine hygiene and, you know, how to take a girl out on a date, all that shit.
Yeah.
That also, the message movies that were coming out in the 50s, so you have a lot of social commentary films, and a lot of films about race relations or, you know, classism or gang warfare. So there was that happening at the same time as well. So it was kind of a merging of those, plus television being in everyone's home and being so issues based anyway. So why not have it within the construct of commercial sitcoms? And then the transitional point of television. So you get the early part of television, which was pretty much a showcase of people who were stars on stage or screen, the Loretta Young show, you know, the, what's his name? Marlo's dad, Danny Thomas show.
Danny Thomas, yeah.
Yeah, all those sort of shows that showcased a star. Then you transition into actual real narrative stuff, so Lucy and stuff. And then escapist television. So your Gilligan's Island, your Munsters, your Bewitched, etc. Then, of course, someone like Norman Lear comes in and basically wants to say to audiences, this medium, this, you know, thing called the situation comedy can actually say something really important about what's going on. Because prior to that, all those shows were escapist fare, and I freaking love them. I'm sure you guys do.
Oh, yeah.
And they're beautiful. They're really comforting as well. But 70s hits, and then it's Norman Lear sort of leading the way with other people following, saying we're going to, you know, flip it onto the audience and say, here's what's going on in the world, and we're going to make massive commentary on it. And so what happens there is it becomes issues-based television in the realm of situation comedy. But then when you get a little bit into it and outside of the sort of hard-hitting shows that set up themselves as hard-hitting shows that are issues-based, and you get to things like Give Me a Break and Full House and all those other shows that come later, they will always sort of go back to what the Norman Lear mold was with at least one or two episodes throughout their run. Right. And they'll go, oh, we'll deal with child molestation on Full House. That'll rattle some, you know, cages. And they do it. And, you know, in particular, that's quite a good episode. But, yeah, so I think it's like a... Half of it makes, like, the cynic in us would say it's just a ratings cash-in or it's like a gimmick, as you mentioned, but a lot of it actually just does come from genuine interest in the issues and also a nice platform for these people who are so well-regarded in comedy to really do a dramatic performance. So if you think of something like the Maud Bears Her Soul episode, Bea Arthur can make you laugh with just an eyebrow raise, but she has this whole one-woman show where she's in tears talking about her father and all this, and it's freaking incredible. You're like, okay, these people are artists. These people are actually incredible performers. Michael J. Fox and My Name is Alex. So they can do more than make you laugh, and I think that's something as well that the shows do, and that's what the platform was for a lot of the producers as well and the writers. And hearing people like Richard Vaxey, when I interviewed him about Golden Girls stuff, that was just mind-blowing because he was like, you know, the studio would be like, we'd like to do an episode on suicide within the elderly community. And then he'd go off and, you know, co-write it and stuff and then not be happy with it and sort of say, fuck, we felt like it was kind of pushed upon us and we didn't have time to develop it. So there's all this stuff that goes into the making of it where people kind of, you know, and question things. And then there's like insane episodes, like the Too Close for Comfort episode that you will know, the rape one where Monroe is raped by two, you know, large ladies. And that was kind of like, so Jim J. Bullock is in the book and he talks about it. And it was like, he felt like the writers themselves were doing it just to get out of working the show. Like, you know, so it was like, let's just do this fucking outlandish show so we can just move on to like maybe working on the Golden Girls or something instead. So there's all this sort of stuff that I think is really fascinating. And I think it's like the cynic in me sort of maybe sees them as sort of, you know, cash grabs and fads or playing into fads. But 90% of what I feel is they actually did come from a genuine place, because I think a lot of them do take on subject matter quite successfully. I think some of them are really clumsy. And then if you see them, like I've done a lecture on them, and I for instance, I presented the AIDS episode of Mr. Belvedere called Wesley's Friend, and there's a really awkward moment, and then there's a really beautiful sentimental moment, and I played the two clips one after the other, and the audience was like, okay, the episode, you know, where the kid comes in and Eileen Graff as the mum goes, hey, Danny, and she goes, how are you? He goes, oh, besides having AIDS, I'm okay, or whatever, and the audience is like, okay. But then the next clip that I show, which comes later in the episode, is the Danny kid and Wesley just having this beautiful moment where Wesley realizes that Danny might not be able to do all the sort of fun stuff that he'll be able to do, you know, growing up. So, you know, it's, and the audience was crying. So it's like, yes, so you get it. So there's all the awkward shit. Yes.
Yeah.
But there's also this really cool stuff that's really moving.
So were you able to talk to Bob Uecker at all about this?
I wish. No, I had Eileen Graff's in the book and she was great. So she gave a lot of insight. Yeah, it's so weird because I've done so much work in film criticism for years now, and film people are really fucking easy to get.
Yeah.
Whereas TV people is like, why aren't you responding to me? Like, it was just insanely hard.
Yeah, you're not doing anything. The Brewers are finished. You can talk.
I know. It's just so weird. But yeah, no, it was good fun creating that book. And yeah, people like Barbara Gallagher, who, you know, wrote a couple of episodes of things like Mary Tyler Moore and Maud and Saturday Night Live and stuff, sketches for that. But she was amazing. She was really insightful into that world of television then. And yeah, there's a few people in there. Shavar Ross, who talks about being Dudley, and his, like, I'll leave it for you guys to read, but his response about the Bicycle Man episode is really, I was like, ah, okay. Like, it was really surprising. It was like not at all what I expected.
Go ahead, Jeff.
He was proud to be shirtless in that episode.
We spent a good part of the late.
So weird.
Yeah, the good part of the late 80s, Jeff and I would be in class or whatever, and we'd just look at each other and go, Dudley, doing the father's voice. But to your point, they like we talk about, they may have been gimmicks or ratings, whatever. What do we still talk about today? We talk about those episodes. We talk about, I even remember an episode when I was a kid, Leave It to Beaver, of course, long off the air, but always in reruns and syndication. And I remember an episode with Beaver had a friend whose parents were divorced. And the kid had to go home. He was spending the night at the house, and the kid had to go home because his mom had the fear or whatever. That was some weird shit to be on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a black and white, you know, show that was just goofy all the time. So there was a little of that even in Leave It to Beaver. I don't know if you know that episode that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. So Amanda Reyes, who's an amazing TV historian, she wrote a great book called Are You in the House Alone, which is a compendium of TV movies, and I contributed to that. She contributed to this book, and she talks about Beaver's friend, which is basically Andy and Beaver, which is about an alcoholism. So okay. Andy's this older guy who's an alcoholic. And absolutely, you're totally right. So divorce sort of is talked about as well in early episodes. But there are early examples. There's a race relations sort of good neighbor policy episode of I Love Lucy. Mm-hmm. There's like a Addams Family episode that really stung me as a kid because I was upset. I still am obsessed with the Addams Family, where there were long moments of no laughing. I was like, what is this? And it was an episode about a beatnik who has a really estranged relationship with his father. And the Addams Family, being who they are, they love everyone,
right,
try and bring them together. and they're really sweet to this beatnik character. And it's all about the generation gap, but there's these really moving moments where it's sort of talking about that directly to a young audience and to parents trying to understand their, you know, their kids. But yeah, early examples definitely exist, but it really starts to kick off with Norman Lear. But the early examples are there, and also the cusp of the early examples prior to All in the Family. So things like the Bewitched episode Sisters at Heart, which dealt with race, which was written actually by public high school kids, which is really, really? Sweet. And yeah, and Elizabeth Montgomery brought them over to the set to let them see the show unfold. Brady Bunch had a few. So there's a whole bunch of sort of early examples, and they're in the book. So I try and do as many as possible. There's a Mr. Ed episode, which I love, which is all about environmentalism.
Really?
Yeah. It's really fascinating just to sort of see where things are headed and what they're sort of tapping into. And a lot of them, interestingly enough, are backdoor pilots that never went anywhere. So there's a really interesting episode called Callie's Kids from the Brady Bunch, which is supposed to be this spin-off of Carol and Mike's friends who adopt a black kid, a white kid, and an Asian kid. And it's like, you know, race stuff, racial harmony. Right. But yeah, it's good stuff. I'm a big fan of it.
Jeff?
You want to mention some more people that you interviewed for the book?
Who else did I interview? There weren't that many, but they gave a lot of good stuff. Richard Vaxey, I mentioned, Eileen Graff. Oh, Sherry Johnson, who played Sherry in Punky Brewster. She was great. She gave some cool stuff to talk about, especially like that whole period of like, do you know where your kids are? And the whole the child empowerment movement, and also the Just Say No campaign from
the drugs on the table.
Yeah, so she was really, yeah, she was great. Yes.
Punky.
Who else is in there? Adrienne Barbeau, Queen Adrienne. So she's in there talking about Maud, and she was great. And she had like really cool insight into learning all about comedy from Bea Arthur and learning all about drama from John Carpenter.
Wow.
And she said this thing where Bea Arthur really taught her how to sort of be the straight woman or the anchor to the comedy, and Carpenter sort of taught her how to act for film, because Adrienne's early work was stage. She was in musicals. She did Grease. She was the first Rizzo. And she did a really amazing sexploitation nudie musical called Stag Movie. And yeah, it's amazing. Google
it. Down.
But yeah, she's terrific. She's wonderful, and she gives great insight. Plus, what I loved hearing about is that she actually opened her own women's clinic after doing Maud, because Maud sort of, she said Maud made her more politically active, and she had this women's clinic where she would actually offer abortions for women. So she was like this amazing, you know, phenomenal feminist, it still is, and an amazing woman who did a lot of work thanks to working on something like Maud, which was so important, vitally important. And also, that's the other thing that's beautiful about these shows. They actually didn't just sort of, you know, frighten the horses or inspire people like us. Mm-hmm. They actually changed legislation and helped change votes, which is fucking incredible. If you think of something like Cousin Liz, which was all about gay teachers being allowed to work, being allowed to teach. All in the Family does this episode, and it all talks about that during the period of the Joe Briggs initiative and the Anita Bryant sort of, you know, deal there, where they were doing a proposition where basically gay teachers weren't allowed to teach, and that show aired and it gave a face to lesbian school teachers. And it changed votes. It made people go, fuck, no, these people need to work.
All in the Family helped so many people generationally repair things that had been torn apart maybe in the 60s and early 70s. The Vietnam veteran episode especially, where Archie misinterprets how he thinks his friend's going to feel about this draft dodger that's Mike's friend who's down from Canada.
Oh, so good.
And it's such a great episode how they... everything gets reconciled. And of course, Archie can't put it together in his mind. You know, he can't understand it. Or like the episode where he thinks that, God, what's that act? Anthony Geary is in an episode. He plays one of Mike's friends and his name is Roger. And he goes, twinkle toes, Roger. And you know, all this dialogue you can't say on TV anymore. But he thinks Roger's gay. And then he goes down to Kelly's and he finds out that his bruiser of a football friend, ex-football player, is a gay guy. But he's a big tough guy. So doing all that on primetime TV in that era just ripped everything away from, you know, ripped the veneer off. look at
and
this.
Pissed off conservatives. There's that great audio clip of Nixon saying, "I was watching television and this horrible show was on." These lefties like Norman Lear. Blah, blah. And it scared people. Good. Like, you know, that's fantastic. And the disclaimer for the first few episodes, you know, this show is meant to sort of expose our own prejudices and make jokes of it, because Archie is a lovable bigot. He is so ridiculously bigoted and that you laugh at him, but you also love him.
Right.
And what I like to champion as well is the fact that they're complex characters. They're not just two-dimensional characters. The first sort of time you ever see Archie really emote on a very sentimental and tender moment is Gloria has a valley full where Gloria has a miscarriage. And he goes upstairs to see her. It's an early episode. Before that, every episode is him, hating on everyone. But this moment, in the bedroom with his daughter and can't speak, and she says, it gives me chills. She goes, "I didn't do good, Daddy, or didn't do a good job." And he can't speak, and then she says, "You love me." And then he's like, and she goes, "I love you too," and it ends. And that's the first time you get to see the heart of Archie and who he is, and it's really sweet. And I think, you know, people like Carol O'Connor, oh my God, you know. And so the beauty of Archie and someone like Maud is you laugh at Archie because he's such a bigot and he's such a doofus, but he's got this heart. And you laugh at Maud because she's such an overbearing liberal. Like, she's
yes.
Which is great. But then
come on, Maud, I don't want to deal with it today. Come on, Maud. And her husband is so browbeat, but he... episode where Florida doesn't want to work... Or no. James doesn't want Florida to work anymore. And they didn't have the show yet, but it's James and Florida. Yep. Good times. And Maud is trying to play the meddlesome liberal who knows what's best for people of color. And her husband's like, no. But then you have the two men who are like, no, you're going to do it the way I say, because I'm the husband. And that episode just unfolds. But Maud learns, maybe I shouldn't be so meddlesome. Yeah. That show was great. Whenever I heard that theme song coming on as a kid, I knew I had to go to bed, because that was on later. But All in the Family, I was allowed to watch. So I would sit with my grandparents, and they would watch all these CBS shows and NBC shows, all these shows. All those shows. Norman Lear was great, the king of all that. Jeff, did you?
I just got the book, so I haven't made it to the 80s yet. But were you able to talk to Jerry Jewell from Facts of Life?
I tried to get in touch with her. Someone had her connection on Facebook, and I messaged her, but there was nothing. I really wish I did, because I love her. There's a really beautiful, profound statement that she says in that episode that she actually conceived, and it became like a war cry for people living with disabilities. It was something like, I hate to paraphrase it, but it was something like, questions don't hurt, ignorance does. Mm. And that was something that she says in the episode, and it became like a war cry. It became something that was like a, you know, part of that sort of disability rights movement. And the Cousin Jerry episode is remarkable because, like we've just sort of discussed with, say, Archie and also with Maud, they're complicated. So is Blair. Mm-hmm. And Lisa Welchel, who's stunning, I love her. She comes across as someone who's embarrassed of her cousin, but she's not. She's jealous. And that shift when Mrs. Garrett, God bless Mrs. Garrett, we all need one of her in our life.
Yes,
she goes, "Oh, you're jealous of Cousin Jerry," and I think that's so brilliant. And then Jerry, throughout the series, when she'd pop up, would just add so much to it, and disability starts to sort of recede as an important issue. It's just people. It's just these amazing women and girls.
We talked to her last year. It was episode 26 of our fourth season. But yeah, we talked to her, primarily reached out to talk Deadwood, but we also covered a lot of the Facts of Life stuff. And I remember seeing her on that episode. And then whenever she was booked on a talk show or something, I would go out of my way to watch, because she was a stand-up comedian and she was really, really funny. And again, we take all that stuff for granted now. To go back to 1984 and 1985 and to see somebody with a disability in a prime space on a television show wasn't exactly normal, and it was rare, not normal, but rare. And once you got past that, I was like, oh, she's just a real funny lady, and she's a real and she's a good actress, and she makes the show funny. And I just loved it. Like, butt out Blair and putting Blair in her place, and you're like, yeah, take that, you snooty rich blonde lady.
But then the beauty of Blair is there's so much depth there. There's a really beautiful episode where the two older girls, Joe and Blair, are about to graduate, and Mrs. Garrett gives them a parting gift. And she gives Joe, from memory, a rock. But if you flip the rock, there's all this kind of quartz crystals. And she's, you know, it's like, oh, you got the hard exterior. And there's all this, this gem. It's just beautiful. And then with Blair, I can't remember what she actually gives her. But she oh, maybe like an old sweater or something. And she has no words of advice. And Blair's like, where's my words of advice? She goes, and then Mrs. Garrett grabs her and she says, out of everyone at this school, you've grown the most, and I consider you an equal and a friend. And it's true, because Blair has the biggest arc. She actually grows the most. And by the end of the series, I just recently watched all the facts of life. She ended up becoming broke because she buys Eastland out of poverty, out of bankruptcy. And so she's stripped of what she's known for, which is money. And then becomes this den mother that Mrs. Garrett was, and that show never took off. That was meant to spin off another show. And the actual last two episodes has like a new theme that's kind of leading into the show, but it doesn't take off. And Juliette Lewis was in it.
Really?
And yeah. And who's the other young girl that was? Oh, Blossom. Blossom's in it. Mayim, whatever her name is.
Mayim Balak, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Terrible of me. But yes, she's in there.
Jeff.
Want to talk Sticks a little, or you want to?
Yeah, go Sticks.
The Fonzie's Friend episode of Happy Days.
Yeah, beautiful. That's in the book. Yeah, great. Mate, like the race stuff's really interesting. I think it's like I don't feel like there's any kind of awkward episodes, because I feel like they're really written with not a hypersensitivity, but a sensitivity. And I think that's a really good example. Whereas like the Black-centric shows, which are really solid and strong as well, like Good Times and the Jeffersons, just really nail it in, and they're far more funny in regards to race relations and dealing with that issue. And also things like Maud, you mentioned the Florida and Maud relationship, which is awesome, because I always loved Florida kind of and Carol, you know, sort of teaming up against Maud because they thought Maud was such a buffoon.
Yeah.
but yeah, I think that the Happy Days stuff's really cool, the race stuff. I think that's a really interesting episode, and just how cool the Fonz is, because you have to remember Fonzie ends up becoming kind of an icon for a lot of things outside of the show. So Henry Winkler would do things like literacy is cool, and rent, you know, going to the library is cool, and you know, don't be a racist idiot, you know, all this stuff.
You and me.
These characters sort of existed out of their shows. They became like PSA kind of mascots.
Yeah.
So I think that episode with the race relations stuff and the way it ends with that beautiful party, I think it's a really good, successful episode. I love that one.
And what a villain it made out of Kirk, Officer Kirk.
Oh, hell yeah.
Comes in and then they all, I am so-and-so and I'm so-and-so. It was like an I am Spartacus moment in that episode.
Yes, yes. And Officer Kirk, you know, he reappears and he's also not just, you know, a villain as far as like racial equality goes and stuff, but also about class, because there's a class episode, and also youth, you know, counterculture.
It does a good job of saying the kids are kind of cool with whatever, but it's the parents that are the racist.
Yeah,
the parents aren't going to let you hang out with this black kid, but the kids are okay with it.
The kids are cool. Yeah, yeah.
Then you think in real life. How could it have been that way in reality? You know, we weren't around in the 50s, of course. And you think, how could this be real? And then you talk to people who were alive then, and it was probably far worse than what you see on television. Mm-hmm. But it's just amazing because we didn't grow up in that kind of environment, a different one perhaps, but not that kind of environment. And it just always floored me that how the hell could we have acted that way? But I had a broader question about now, all these shows that created out of Hollywood and then went all over the world. How do you get caught in that in another country? I mean, granted, you know, Australia, you know, former British, whatever. I don't know what it's called, the Anglosphere or something like that. I don't know, whatever. Culturally similar, I guess, but different. How does that happen?
I mean, besides just to answer you, we grew up throughout the 70s and 80s, especially, I would say 95% of content that was fed to our television networks was American. There was definitely British stuff. There was definitely, you know, some Australian content. But it's funny when I speak to Americans and they go and they'll talk about Australian movies they love. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's cool. I like them too. But they're not stuff that I grew up with. Most of the stuff I grew up with was American.
Is there anything?
Australia is very, very Americanized, which is why there's a lot of resentment from a lot of Australians.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I remember growing up as a teenager and, like, you know, it's different when you talk about music. So, like, you know, music, it's like, yeah, yeah, of course we love the Stooges and, you know, whatever. But as soon as you start talking about TV, especially TV, there was, I remember back in the 90s, from fellow teenagers and whatever, a kind of snobbery towards American sitcoms, especially. And it was like, oh, fuck off. So I was like always championing, you know, Who's the Boss or Growing Pains, where everyone else was like watching something like Monty Python, which, you know, I don't care. Like, I don't care. So it was kind of, there was a snobbery and I was like all for Mona. You know, I was more Team Mona than Team Monty Python.
What from Australia do we not know of, or are we not aware of that we should be? Television wise, things like
Kingswood Country. So Kingswood Country was the response to All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And it's not great, but I grew up on it as well. And it was like, you know, it was exactly the same thing. So even like the Edith character was sort of modeled on the same kind of thing, but not at all as successful. The daughter's partner, however, was, I believe, Italian. So a derogatory word, which is, like basically a really derogatory word for someone like me, so someone who is of European heritage. So I'm Maltese. So if you're Italian or Greek or German or Polish or blah, 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 you're a and if you're a white, you know, Anglo, so if you're British, then you're a skip. If that's that's like a honky. But so these words get thrown around much like the way certain words get thrown around in All in the Family. And I hate that we can't fucking say these words just in context. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But that's what happens with this show. So Kingswood Country is basically the Australian variant of that. And of course, All in the Family is the American version of Till Death Do Us Part.
Right.
But what else was the best stuff come out of Australia as far as comedy was concerned for television that I loved was a show called Fast Forward, which had an amazing amount of talent. There was like Magda Savansky, Jane Turner, Gina Riley, Steve Weiser, all these amazing people. And I think Kath and Kim became something quite popular in America, possibly. And that's way later. But Fast Forward was a sketch show. And they do really, really well thought out sketches. And a lot of their parody stuff was freaking spot on. Like they do like parodies of films and TV shows. And it was really, you know, totally un-PC, you know, thank God. But just really fun and really well sharply written stuff. And countering that was a more sort of highbrow sketch comedy, and that was The Late Show. And I remember there was like a division between people. So people like me who really loved, you know, Family Ties and Who's the Boss and The Facts of Life and Designing Women loved Fast Forward. And everyone who was a snob and loved British stuff loved the Late Show. And it was like the university kind of fucking mindset, whereas I was like, you know, working class, you know, give me a Lampoon of the Munsters, please. But that was it. So, yeah, I feel like the sitcom thing is, it's classism. The sitcom is for working class,
Roseanne was for the working class back when it started, you know, and it became something else. It became every season there were two or three very special episodes. You always knew when Ernie Anderson, tonight on, and then on a very special Roseanne.
Yeah. Voice so I think I write about that in the book in the intro about the role of what I'd consider dramedy. So that sort of starts to become something quite popular in the 90s, like Roseanne sort of spearheading it, even Cheers to a certain degree. So there's a lot of shows where...
Oh, yeah, Cheers, sure.
Yeah, there'd be overriding arcs that sort of dealt with sort of serious matter, whether it's Sam Malone's, you know, drinking or Jackie getting beaten or whatever. So, you know, these things sort of recurring. So they're not really, you know, a standalone episode. They're sort of an arc thing. And I think shows like Mary Tyler Moore do that, and all these shows that kind of have arcs for their characters rather than, oh, tonight this character gets, you know, sexually harassed and then next week they're fine.
Dudley rides a bike.
Yeah. And this is just volume one.
Yes.
So tell everybody a little what they can look forward to in volume two, and then make sure you tell everybody where they can find the books.
Yeah, cool. So because it became so huge, I think there's over 200 pieces, so 200 things are covered. The publisher were like, oh, can we do two volumes? And at first I was hesitant, but then I was like, yeah, just do it, it's fine. Yeah. So the first volume goes from 56 to 85, and then the next volume is 86 to 98. And there's also some very honorable mentions as well. So non-sitcoms being talked about. So things like the dark episodes of Little House on the Prairie, the episode of Sesame Street where the old guy dies.
Mr. Hooper.
Super, thank you. And also overviews of Norman. Oh, hello.
Hi.
Oh, sorry. I just got a pop up. Overviews of people like Susan Harris and Norman Lear. But yeah, so there's a whole bunch of stuff, and then integrated other interviews relating to the certain episodes. So Julie Cobb gives an interview for a Charles in Charge episode, which deals with working moms. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. Like I think if you're a fan of the very special episode, you'll get a kick out of it. And there's a lot of like cultural sort of stuff. I don't know how deep you want to go, but there's like things like what was happening culturally at the same time of these episodes sort of being made or coming out at the same time. It's interesting that a lot of the sort of gender ones or the losing virginity or the coming out episodes happen, they aired around Valentine's Day. So there's like a structure there. There's also a lot of stuff with Christmas, like a lot of episodes dealing with homelessness always happen around Christmas. Like it's really weird, the trends and stuff, but it kind of makes sense.
But it's a way to bring the social issues of the day into the show at the right time for it to make an impact on the audience.
Yeah, definitely. But then also remain timeless enough so we can rewatch it and go, oh, that's still the same thing. Or, you know, because I'm not a believer in things being, you know, dated. I hate those terms. Like I hate when critics write things like for its time and dated. It does my head in because you should be able to grab it. You don't go look at a Picasso and go, oh, that's good for its time. You just don't do that.
That's what Canada's doing now with the Brady Bunch. They're putting... CTV is putting disclaimers before the Brady Bunch saying this show is a product of its time.
Wow.
Brady Bunch.
Is that so people aren't offended?
I guess. I don't know who'd be offended by the Brady Bunch. People who don't like getting hit in the face with footballs. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or they don't like that little kid in the last season.
Cousin Oliver.
Yeah. I'm an Oliver. Anti-Oliver.
Robbie Wrist.
Yes.
That's right. The add-on. But so there's a bunch of stuff. I'm really proud of it. It took a while. There's a lot of contributors, and they all did a really marvelous job. Everyone did a really, you know, they got into because all the contributors are big fans as well. So that really comes across in the writing. No one's kind of like writing about them at arm's length because a lot of critics do that. They go, oh, what's this fucking Charles in Charge? So they're all writing it from a place of love, which is good because there is unfortunately a lot of snobbery towards sitcoms, and there shouldn't be.
I know.
They're wonderful. They're wonderful things. But so there's some really interesting sitcom episodes that I think get overlooked because other ones overshadow them. So you mentioned The Bicycle Man, right? So The Bicycle Man is, you know, the two-part. You've got Conrad Bain at the start going, you know, parents, sit down with your kids and let's talk about, you know, this horrible subject. And it's an amazing double episode. And Gordon Jump, you know, unfortunately, when he died, people just referred to him as the guy that played the Bicycle Man.
No, they didn't care about
WKRP. It's incredible fucking career.
Right, WKRP.
Yeah, I know. So that episode's great. But I actually really get stressed out with the counsellor from Mr. Belvedere. Like, that's really ugly because why it's uglier is because the pedophiles are, like, more terrifying because it's so normal and so appealing, you know, in a sense. Like, this is someone who you could be mates with because he's, you know, athletic and he's cool and he gets you nice things. But that whole moment where he does what he does is the biggest betrayal and so vile and horrific So I think that's more chilling than Gordon Jump, you know, leering around.
Hey, you guys want some wine?
Yeah. And the other Different Strokes episode that I actually find more confronting than The Bicycle Man is The Hitchhikers, where Kimberly's nearly raped.
Yeah.
Like, that is full on. Like,
that one was rough.
Gary Coleman in the gaffer tape. Jesus. Yep. And you get to see Dana Plato do this performance, and she's phenomenal. Like, it really upsets me when people sort of poo-poo child actors. And
oh, no, they were good. They were really good.
They were freaking awesome, yeah. And it's heartbreaking to see what happened to a lot of them. But, you know, a lot of them are survivors as well. But I think when you see Dana Plato and you see her vulnerabilities in these episodes, it's beautiful. It's, like, really poignant. I love the bulimia episode, which is her last on-screen appearance in Different Strokes. And you see the frailty in this person, yeah. You know. I think that's, you know, it's there to see. I mean, hopefully it makes people understand things like bulimia or, you know, drug addiction or whatever.
And it's a shame what happened to her. Todd Bridges is still around. He's on Twitter. He's an interesting follow. He's an interesting cat. And we hope that someday we can speak to him as well.
Yeah.
Lee, there's so much. I mean, we could talk for hours and all day, and I would love to do that, actually. But certainly don't have the time. But, I mean, where can people find the book? Other than
Amazon.
Or you go to Amazon and get it, of course, but you know what I mean.
Yes, but you're probably best to do from direct from the publisher, bearmannermedia.com.
Okay.
Because it's always nice to order direct.
Oh yeah. Don't give Jeff Bezos any more money if you don't have
it. Has volume 2 been released, or is it coming soon?
Yeah, it's out. It's out
now, okay. Out
now. Yeah. Which is cool.
Awesome. Well, I thank that you took the time to get with us. Jeff, did you want to talk or ask any more questions, Jeff?
No, I'm good. I'd recommend all our listeners get the book.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is right in our wheelhouse for volume 1.
Absolutely. I'm going to geek out with both volumes. Like, that's my reading material for the rest of the year.
Oh, cool. Thanks, guys.
Really appreciate it. And so it's late night over there, right?
Yeah, it's not though. It's 12:30.
12:30. So
I work way into like about 2 to 3 doing this.
That's keeping awesome. Those
Hunter Thompson late night hours.
It's Halloween here. Like, you guys have just started Halloween. This is we're wrapping it up, and I have the Raggedy Ann and Andy Halloween thing, the pumpkin that couldn't smile. You seen that?
Yeah. No, I remember, but I. I tried to watch Halloween last night, but I couldn't find an uncensored version, so I just stopped and watched Eli Roth's documentary, or his docuseries on AMC.
I consulted on that one. I did stuff on the Evil Kid episode.
Oh, great. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great show, too. Is there anything new that's out in the world these days that you're into? Or are you like only...
like a new film?
Or like Ted Lasso. Have you seen Ted Lasso at all? It's really from the creator of Scrubs. Every episode is from the heart, touching.
Right. Okay.
I recommend it highly.
I haven't seen much new television I've actually sort of gravitated to, but I am looking forward. You mentioned Halloween. I am looking forward to the next Halloween, because I saw the latest one, obviously, and I bought it. And upon, like, maybe the fourth viewing, I'm like, oh, I'm actually warming to this film. You know, just kill the fucking podcasters earlier, please, Mark.
But I just
to digress for a moment with the Halloween thing, I just really loved Laurie, the character of Laurie in H2O, mm-hmm. because she's got so much more to do.
Yes.
In this film, it's kind of like a bit one note. And I feel like in H2O, my God, the arc there is brilliant. Like, she's, you know, booze riddled, and she's got issues with the sun, and she's, you know, just a really, it's a dynamite performance from Jamie Lee. This one's great, but it's just sort of, you know, a bit Sarah Connor.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm like, where's the vulnerability?
Right. Now, H2O, is that the one where she's at the boarding school?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's the one I like. LL Cool J's in that too, and I love him in that movie.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, Steve Miner film.
Yeah. Well, Lee, dude, it's so great talking to you, and I hope someday we can talk to you again. And because we love TV. I mean, you're not a geek, but you know what I mean. People who geek out on TV and love it as much as we do, it's freaking awesome. So.
Excellent. Everybody, thanks, guys.
Yeah. What, Jeff?
Get the book.
Oh yeah, everybody, get the book. Damn it. Go out and buy the book. Don't get the audio book. Hold it in your hands and read it.
I'm going to get volume two since I finished this one.
All right.
Where are you up to in it, Jeff?
I'm in the 70s.
Okay, cool.
1970s.
Very good. Yes, there's a lot in there. And like even things that people kind of neglect, I think, like sometimes people wouldn't think of MASH having them, but of course it does, you know.
Oh, yeah. And they were all fascinating. They were all amazing actors on that show. Can do drama, comedy.
And writers. Yes. Incredible writers.
Nope.
See, the thing is as well with the ride, like Richard Vaxey had amazing stuff. So you mentioned you weren't allowed to watch Maud because it was too late. Richard Vaxey, who ended up writing and producing The Golden Girls, was not allowed to watch Maud because of the content. And so he started on The Golden Girls in his early 20s. And he said the core writing team for The Golden Girls were young men in their 20s.
Really?
That is stunning. And I go, doesn't that just do this? It gives a big up yours to people who have that stupid argument where you have to be who you're writing for. And he's like, absolutely. It's about empathy. It's about just being a creative. You're a writer. Therefore, you should, if you're, you know, a Jewish man with, you know, one arm, you can write about people with two arms who are
right. Christian. That's why my grandmother and I could sit and watch reruns of Golden Girls and both laugh at the same time at the same joke.
Exactly. Yeah. What a show.
Absolutely. Well, Lee, thank you very much. I hope you have a nice summer, right? You're going into summer.
Yes, it gets hot.
Yes, yes. Now it's cold. Complain.
Yeah.
Well, take care and good luck with the book. And we'll be plugging it and talking about it for, I'm sure, a couple of weeks now.
We'll love to have you back on when we get to volume two.
Yeah, absolutely. Please come on. Oh,
cool. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
All right. How do we say it without being condescending? Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
All right. That was terrible. All right. Thank you. See you later.
See you. Bye.
Thanks, Matt.
Hey, Radio Labyrinth is brought to you by Atlanta Pizza and Gyro, who are open. And you can go to their website and find out all that information. You can go in there, sit down, have yourself a nice, delicious meal, bring the family. They have a great staff and a great owner. Atlanta Pizza and Gyro. Their website is atlantapizzagyro.com. You can order online and when you order online, you can do pickup or delivery, and you don't have to pay till you get there. So don't worry about that. You don't have to pay ahead of time. Atlanta Pizza and Gyro wants to thank everyone who has been supportive to them and to other restaurants through these tough times for the entire industry. And listen, if you have been to Atlanta Pizza and Gyro, I implore you, please leave a review on Google. And we can't forget our friend Brett Perkins, who I did reach out to. But I haven't heard back from. Get Brett Perkins, I said, the super across the way. And his business, LDI Repro Printing of Athens. They have all of your construction printing needs, commercial or residential, in Athens since 2005 with a fast turnaround and affordable prices. Call 706-316-9366 or email them at athens@ldiline.com. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much, Lee Gambin. That was really cool. I want to talk to him again, Jeff. So let's do that. Like, but maybe when the second volume comes out, because there's just so. Like,
I feel the second volume is actually out now, but
oh, it is.
Let's read them and then we'll get back with them.
Yeah, because we just barely scratched the surface, and he knows so much about. Like, he was talking about shows I didn't even watch, you know, because once
encyclopedic knowledge of old classic sitcoms.
Yeah,
from our youth.
And he was getting ready to, like you said, he was getting ready to watch the Raggedy Ann and Andy, that Sad Pumpkin Halloween special. I mean, how obscure is that special? They don't show that. I don't even know that I've ever seen it. Maybe I did. I don't know. But yeah, we definitely got to talk to him again. So it is now time. The Red Box Troll. My name is Ian Nubbinsworth. And we're going to play a little game. It's like Mad Libs, but it's different. And we take a movie synopsis, and you try to figure out the movie. Well, those two will. So if you're ready, I'll start.
Okay.
All right.
Jeff, name a type of school.
Montessori school.
Dustin, name a school course.
Math.
Jeff, an adjective.
Purple.
Dustin, an adjective.
Big.
Jeff, female body part.
Mulva.
Dustin, action verb.
Strike.
Jeff, official title.
President.
Dustin, adjective.
Lonely.
Jeff, noun.
Dildo.
Dustin, group of people.
Proud Boys.
Jeff, adjective.
Sleepy.
Dustin, noun, occupation.
Doctor.
Jeff, action verb.
SWAT.
Dustin, adjective. There's a lot of adjectives.
Scary.
Jeff, noun.
Shoe.
And last, Dustin, one last adjective, please.
Ugly.
All right, here we go. Let's see. Jim McAllister, a well-liked Montessori maths teacher, can't help but notice that purple student Tracy Flick uses less than her big vulva to get what she wants. When Tracy strikes out for school president, Jim feels she will be a lonely influence on the dildo Proud Boy's body and convinces Paul, a dim-witted but sleepy student doctor, to swat Tracy. When she becomes aware of Jim's scary involvement in the shoe, an ugly feud is sparked. Do you know the movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
What is
re-election? Re-election? Her election? Yep.
Mm-hmm.
She had the tightest.
That's a great movie, by the way. Very underrated film. That was funny as shit.
I seen it in the theater and walked out.
You did.
And then watched it again about 5 years later and really enjoyed it. It just didn't hit. I didn't click.
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't what you were expecting from a Matthew Broderick.
No, not at all.
Movie.
Yeah, it's the first time Matthew Broderick ever played like a sad sack or a loser, as far as I know. And I mean, he ended up being happy at the end. No, spoiler alert. But if you've never seen the movie Election, see if you can find it someplace. It's a really entertaining film, and it's a nice morality play, and a good cast and good acting. So,
isn't there a conspiracy theory on that? That the character was supposed to be Ferris Bueller, grown up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
His character, yeah.
Well, why wouldn't they have called? They should have used his name, Ferris Bueller. Maybe they couldn't get the rights.
Yeah.
He was Ferris Bueller in Witness Protection. No, I never heard that theory before. I'll have to check that out. I'm sure there's a video on YouTube about it.
I'm sure there's probably six.
Yeah. So today on our YouTube video, we're going to be breaking down the movie Election. And here are some stills that I'm going to talk over for half an hour. Some of those videos that you watch on YouTube, some are really overproduced and slick and dull. Some of them are really, really long and interesting, but they're too long. Too long. Speaking of long, we haven't had a new Mike TV in a while. So 2 weeks ago, they were like, we're back. What happened to Mike TV? No thoughts? Okay.
My mama told me.
My mama told you to what?
You don't not to say anything. Say.
Oh, well, say nice things. Say nice things. Like Auburn sucks. Or is he a Clemson? Is he an Auburn fan or a Clemson fan? I don't know. They'll find out. He'll tell us.
Oh, you'll find out.
Yeah, on Twitter. I'm a fucking blah, 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 blah. And then Roby will fight with him and it'll be fun.
Yeah.
I love reading their little snarky back and forth.
I know. It's funny. I'll wait and then catch up on a thread that's like 50 posts long.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jeff sometimes weighs in with like one snarky comment. It's a lot of fun. So who watched The Mandalorian?
First one.
Yes. It was very, very good. I love that you can't binge it. I love that you can only watch it once a week. It keeps it feeling like an old school television show. Watching it feels like an old school. I mean, first of all, we talked about this last season. It is a Western.
There's a bunch of idiots out there, though. They're like, "Why can you only watch one? What the fuck?"
I know. I know.
They waited until the entire first season was bingeable, then binged it,
mm-hmm.
and didn't realize that it's only coming out once a week.
Millennials don't know how to watch TV like we do because we had to wait. You had to wait every week, and then you had to wait a whole summer. There was nothing on for years. There was nothing new on in the summertime. You because it was just like there'd be a pilot that didn't do well, and that's how it would be listed in the TV guide. Pilot starring George Segal and a couple of actresses, and then it would fail. But you had to wait. Now you don't ever have to wait for anything, which is why I enjoy series that if they're really, really, it's a really good series, it's worth the wait, I think. And it was worth the wait for season two. I mean, that first episode of season two was amazing. You had Timothy Oliphant in it, W. Earl Brown, and a great story. I mean, just a one-off story, the way they should be. A little longer than a half an hour. Was it 40 minutes, 45 minutes?
Yeah.
Almost 50.
About 40, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a great Western. Like when they're walking, you can hear the, what are those things on the cowboy boots that
make spurs?
Yeah, it sounds like they have spurs on and you can hear it. And it was just such an awesome thing. And then Timothy Oliphant playing Marshall Cobb Vanth, who's basically just, I mean, he's a Marshall on two shows right now. He's a Marshall on that and he's a Marshall on Fargo. So.
Yep.
Talking about being
Vanth Refrigeration.
Yeah. Marshall Raylan Cobb Vanth.
Oliphant was on The Office, so he knows who Bob Vanth is.
Who?
Oliphant was on The Office, so he knows who Bob Vanth from Vanth Refrigeration is.
I didn't know this, but you know, Chuck Wendig wrote a trilogy of books that came after, I mean, they're setting the timeline after Return of the Jedi and before Phantom Menace. No, not Phantom Menace, before.
That's how people knew he was going to be wearing the Boba Fett armor.
Really? From those books?
Yeah.
And so we may see him again. We may not. Now, tell me more about W. Earl Brown's character. He was the bartender, right?
Yeah. I guess he was on that show Angel as one of the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of heavy makeup. So he told his agent that he didn't want to do any more makeup gigs.
Right.
He didn't like sitting in the chair for 4 or 5 hours or whatever it takes to get all made up. And his agent got a call from John Favreau and wanted him to be on The Mandalorian. And the agent was like, Earl's not doing makeup roles anymore. And he said, well, this is The Mandalorian. You know, maybe you want to reconsider. And he was like, fuck yes.
Yes. And appear with his erstwhile nemesis from Deadwood.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he was in the episode. It took me a few minutes to figure out that he was, that W. Earl Brown was that character.
The weak way.
Mm-hmm. And you said he has a figure being made?
Oh, he said that they scanned him.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows if they'll make a figure or not.
Is he going to come on and talk to us about it?
I asked him to, so hopefully he will soon.
Oh, that's great. It was such a great episode, too. I mean, the whole story was fantastic and how they mentioned the Sarlacc pit. They're on Tatooine. And again, he has Boba Fett's armor, and it's, I don't know, it's just, I love it. It's the best post-Star Wars Star Wars to me.
And Baby Yoda was funny.
Yeah, Baby Yoda's awesome.
Kids started getting really, pushed the button and closed the little door on himself.
Oh, the other cool thing is how it's the first time you ever see the Tusken people, the Tusken, the Sand people as a collective, as like real entities, not just some. And they have their own language, and somehow the Mandalorian knows how to speak it.
And it shows them brushing the teeth of one of their panthers.
Yeah. And I was thinking, though, why would there be woolly mammoths on a desert planet? That doesn't make any sense. But who cares? And there were Jawas, and there's all sorts of cool shit, man. And if you got tired of Star Wars and you said, I'm not ever watching anything anymore, and you haven't watched The Mandalorian yet, go watch it because it's great. And, you know, if you like Westerns, it's a Western, and it's got all the tropes, but they're done right. And, you know, it's a very, and from start to finish. And then at the end, they have art from the show, which is also pretty damn cool. So there you go. Check out The Mandalorian. That was it. The only other thing I watched this week, guys, did you guys watch Truth Seekers?
Yes.
I watched the first one.
Yeah, I watched the first one too.
What'd you think?
It was okay.
I thought it was a good opening.
Yeah, I thought it started out slow, but I really liked it toward the end, and it was fun, and I love
Simon Pegg was his partner instead of being the boss. That's only in it for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, but his partner's cool.
Yeah, his partner's funny, Elton John.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny when he said his name, because Elton. He said Elton John, and he just kind of looked to the right, ignored it, and kept going.
And Malcolm McDowell talked about this a couple of weeks ago on Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal
Pod. He was hilarious.
Yeah, and he's a great addition to that show. So I guess that's the only thing I watched, except for, you know, countless YouTube videos and old stuff that no one cares about. Jeff, what'd you watch this week?
I watched all the episodes of my next guest's Needs No Introduction, the new David Letterman interviews that are on Netflix. I watched even the Kim Kardashian and the Lizzo ones.
Lizzo's cool. Did he have a good time with her?
Yeah. That one was fun. That was like the only one that was post-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So it was weird to see them interacting in a COVID world.
Oh, really? Did they both have masks on?
Yeah, sort of. For the setup, they did. And then they measured and made sure they were 6 feet apart and all that shit. So,
well, I've told you before, I like her a lot. I mean, I'm not into her music or anything, but I like her as a performer and an interesting person. You know, she just does what she wants, and I like that. You know, people get mad.
But he talks to the people about everything you want him to talk about, even if you're not a fan of them. Like, he got really into the Kim Kardashian, which got robbed in Paris.
Mm-hmm. She spoke about that, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, before you continue, I'll tell you what my stat pick is. Sorry, Jeff. My stat pick is 2 Weeks to Live, which debuts on HBO Max later in the week. It's kind of like a British Killing Eve, apparently, starring Maisie Williams as a doomsday prepper who enlists her brothers on a mission to avenge the murder of their father. So that looks interesting. And I like her, so I'll watch it.
I didn't have a stat pick this week.
What else did you watch?
Watched Impractical Jokers Dinner Party. That funny. Premiered this week.
Pretty funny. It was pretty good. Yeah.
Halloween episode.
What's The Queen's Gambit?
That's a Netflix show with that chick from The Witch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the chess show.
She plays a chess prodigy. Mm. Really good. Really time. What do you call it, a period piece? That's really well done.
Oh, okay. A period piece like Are You There, God? It's like Me, Margaret?
Mad Men.
Okay. Sorry.
No, not a period piece. A period piece.
Well, you know what I meant. Dustin, what did you watch this week?
Well, like I said, we watched the first episode of True Seekers. Enjoyed it. Didn't watch as much. I've listened to Gilbert's Amazing Colossal Podcast. He had Tim Robbins on.
Oh, I know. Today. Yeah, good?
Yeah, it's good. Talks a lot about his father being a musician, kind of a folk musician, and a lot of the groups that he was with. Of course, Santa Padre pulled out everybody in the world that his dad had worked with, and
right.
was amazing, Tim, over what he was remembered and what he didn't about his father's work. A lot, you know, talked about his father's death because his mother and father died 12 days apart.
Wow.
One of those, you know, lovesick where his father died and then his mother had a dream about him the night before she died. And then passed 12 days, you know, after he passed, and he got into that, and it was neat. It was kind of a little roller coaster. It was a little more emotional than most of his stuff, but also just as funny, because there was other he worked with Hervey Velasquez. Oh. Of course, that always brings up everything, and it was good. I enjoyed it. I rewatched on Hulu all of the Roseanne episode, the Halloween episodes.
Uh-huh.
I went through all the seasons and just, we'd kind of watch those back to back. That was fun to watch and fun to remember how good that show was when it was in its prime.
Yeah, absolutely. Before it became an issues show, it was so funny.
Yeah, it was just the you know, they would push the envelope back when it really didn't need to be pushed, but they would do it anyway, and it was so good. And seeing everybody still, you know, younger and still in their prime, and John Goodman just, you know, chewing up scenery on everything. It was great.
Roseanne.
Yeah, them trying to get each other, prank each other back and forth was always fun. Let's see. I just finished Duma Key, Stephen King.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that was really good. It was one of those I'd put off for a long time, and finally got into it.
I never read it. What's it about?
There's a guy who owns a construction company. He's made himself into a millionaire, and then on a job site, a crane backs into his truck and crushes it, mm-hmm. taking his right arm and crushing his head, and so he goes into rehabilitation from it. He loses his wife and, you know, through Tim trying to rehabilitate, they just become different people and separate. So his doctor tells him to move. Is there anything that he enjoyed doing when he was younger? And he said, drawing. And so he said, you know, find a place, move there, you know, throw yourself into your hobby, and that would be a good avenue to recover from. So he goes to this key in the Gulf side of Florida, called Duma Key, and rents a home there. And basically he when he gets there, he just starts, without even knowing what he's doing, painting these beautiful pictures of the sunset on the water. And he starts like he's never, you know, done anything like this before. It just starts flowing through him, and come to find out there's been things that have happened on that island, and it doesn't really have much of a tie with the lore of Stephen King as far as things associated with the tower,
mm-hmm.
but it does have an interesting plot as far as King goes, because he wrote this one during the recovery from his accident when he got hit by the van. So
it and kind saved of, by Roland and Eddie.
Yeah, I know. So it gives a lot of insight into recovery and long-term pain management and things like that, which was kind of an interesting viewpoint. But I enjoyed it, and I finished that one, and I just started 11/22/63.
I love that
book. And then the show is good too.
Yeah, I haven't watched the show yet, so I was going to wait and read it, and then watch the show.
Read the book, because there's a lot left out in the series. But the series is good. It just, there's, you know, that's such a voluminous piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really good. I really enjoyed it.
It ends well too, which is surprising for Stephen King.
Yeah, I like the so far. I mean, I think I'm right to the point where he's in the backyard of the family in Derry, and waiting on Halloween night. And it's neat how the characters from It are pop up, like Richie.
Right.
And Beverly in there, and he talks to them, and it's kind of after it happened, so, or, you know, a few months after it had happened, so, or the
in what 11
yeah 11/22/63 he goes,
I don't remember that.
Yeah, he goes to Derry, and he's walking around, and he sees two kids jitterbug dancing, and he walks up to them, and it's Richie Tozier and Beverly. And he talks to them and knows that they know something about the town that he also, you know, he gets the same vibe off the town,
mm-hmm.
and realizes that they're probably the only sane people.
Doesn't that mess up the story of It though? Because after the conclusion of the first half, the conclusion of when they're children, they develop some sort of amnesia, and there's really no, I mean, they drift off.
The amnesia happens only when they leave town.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. They have to get outside of the draw of where Pennywise is, where the ship landed or whatever.
Okay. Damn. Yeah, it landed during the dinosaur era. According to
But the staff pick, there's a new season, season 4 of Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix. Mm-hmm. He has a new season out on there.
What's Somebody Feed Phil? What's
that? Phil Rosenthal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one that made Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh, okay.
Does the travel food show.
What's the guy that does the YouTube show where comedians come on and eat hot wings? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the hot ones.
Yeah.
Yeah,
hot ones. I watched a couple episodes of that, too, I guess I could mention that. The one with Bill Burr was hilarious because he's so pale, he just keeps getting redder and redder.
Yeah, there's a lot of good episodes of hot ones. And it's been kind of strange since the, of course, with COVID.
Yeah,
they're doing the remotes.
You can cheat if you do it at the house, you know.
It's funny how some of them have it laid out and then have it all laid out just like the show, and some of them are just you can tell they don't follow the same.
Right.
He can push them a little more when he's in front of them.
Yeah,
but it's a little harder to do when they're doing it over Zoom.
I don't know how it just popped up in my recommendation feed, so I watched them, and then I got sucked into a rabbit hole of watching Bill Burr videos and interviews. He's so funny. Mm-hmm. What, Jeff? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the hot ones is good. The game show is terrible, but the YouTube show is good.
I didn't know there was a game show.
Yeah, they had it's good. It's been on a couple seasons on True TV. They'd have people on and they gotta eat the hot wings, and it's not as good as the show.
You could tell it was a producer that just saw how well Hot Ones was doing on YouTube, right, and thought, we gotta be able to make a TV show out of this. And it's like, it just doesn't. The intimacy, I think, is where they lost it. When you put a studio audience in there and do it in front of a crowd, it just doesn't have the same effect.
It seems like they keep the same hot sauces every time. And part of the appeal of the show is they change up what the sauces are for, like, each season.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So they're using different sauces all the time, and they talk about the sauces if you're into that kind of thing.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to watch more of them, I guess.
Yeah, depending on who's on, there's some great ones.
Well, guys, I don't really have much more to offer this week. Anybody have anything else? I mean, I want to thank our guest again. That was an awesome interview, and like I said, we got to talk to him again.
Yeah, we will.
So much fun talking to him about all those episodes. Like, we get into Gordon Jump and Different Strokes. Dustin, it was cool. You'll have to be there next time because this guy, really entertaining.
It sounds fun. You could talk about the bicycle episode of Different Strokes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the subject matter is pretty heavy, but you know, poor Gordon Jump. All right, we'll be back with a new show next week, and it'll be me and Jeff and maybe Dustin and maybe some other people. So please go to our Facebook page, which is just Radio Labyrinth, or you can join the Radio Shack, which is run by Dustin. We have a YouTube page. If you're watching this, you know that already. If you're listening, we have a YouTube page where you can watch us do the podcast. It's youtube.com/Radio Labyrinth, right?
Podcast. Radio Labyrinth Podcast.
Radio Labyrinth Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @radio_labyrinth. And you can become a Patreon if you so desire at patreon.com/Tim Andrews. And again, thank you to everybody and our very brand new Patreon member. And that would be Tracy McCoy. So until next week, please remember to keep it canon.
Happy birthday, Tim.
Thank you, Jeff.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, Dustin. And now we give a shout out to the rest of the donors. Aaron Roberts, Alan Barker, Amber Gilpatrick, Andrew Harbin, Andrew Malazzi, Brian Jackson, Brian Nix, Buck Monterey, Chris Cosentino, Dave Benson, Denise Reynolds, Gwyn Ketchum, Herb Lamb, Jeff Peterson, Jeremy Turman, Jesse Rosinski, Mark Weiland, Randy Reeves, Robert Kearns, Kevin Stokes, Wayne Blair, Ashley Rose, Chris Knight, JW, Kevin Schwartz, Lou Caniglio, Mary Fouquet, Ryan Wilson, Sam Wells, Walt Murray, Bradley A. Schumpert, Brandon C. Pilcher, Dustin Lawler, Jason Heft, Nick Starks, Trent, Wendy Muller, Andrew Hopkins, David C. Funk, Lauren Calderman, Robert Haley, Robert Calderman, Sherry Dougherty, and Tim Slayton. Thank you all very much. We very much appreciate it, and thank you for sticking with us for so very long and all year in this crazy 2020 in which we live. Radio Labyrinth is recorded in front of a live studio audience. Well, the four of us, occasionally three, sometimes four, sometimes three, and is produced by you. For a complete list of Radio Labyrinth's awesome Patreon sponsors, just look at the show notes. Our intro theme was produced and performed by John Mark Lindell. Keep it canon.